welcome to episode 339 of Muse on Minis.
Musing and amusing.
I'm Nigel, and I play Kador.
Brent, and I play Signar.
This is Seabass, and I play Circle.
Well, awesome. We're episode two of season three?
Episode two, season three.
Oh, jeez. Yep. Getting into
I know, summer. Right?
Yeah.
It is. It's so much fun. Like, it's been nice to be back, so.
What do we want to talk about this week, guys?
So, we came up with some topics. We kind of wanted to do talk a little bit about Nemo 3 and the lightning immunity change. I feel like there's a lot of really interesting conversation that needs to happen around that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of an open and shut topic, so it might be more just a perspective check on that. But also this week, juniors get to have their bonded warjacks in theme with them. So Sorsha can have Beasto 9. Kane can have Ace. Sevi, he would want him, could have Blessing of Vengeance. That opens up a lot of interesting things, and I think that'd be a really cool topic to work on. And then also, forgive me if I get the name wrong, and I do apologize, but Aelid Baron Braithwaite writes in, how do you handle and play against someone who outthreats you considerably, right? So kind of as a tactic section, kind of wanted to just talk a little bit about how that disparity looks like in terms of range, and how do we as players, like, how do we kind of mitigate that, and how do we get ourselves on the table without just losing everything to a range dominant list or a list that significantly outthreats us. So those were the topics that I had. Do you guys have anything else you want to talk about tonight?
No, that seems pretty good for my end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sounds great. Let's jump right in there.
First thing we do want to talk about, though, is I don't want anybody to forget. We've got MuseonCon coming up, the third MuseonCon. It's May 18th to the 20th at the Holiday Inn in Des Moines, which is a nice venue. There's all kinds of ticket options. So if you're going to be there for one day or 3 days, whatever the case may be, you have ticket options. And then the schedule of events, we've got War Machine and Hordes, Guild Ball, Infinity, Malifaux, X-Wing, Batman, Blood Bowl, painting competitions, in multiple different classes, as well as multiple different events for the games I just listed. So if you're a miniature gamer and you play anything, you probably need to check out MuseonCon. It's an awesome, awesome convention experience. It's laid back. The time frames are very realistic for start and stop times of events. And it's outfitted with some of the nicest, most awesome people in, the War Machine and Hordes community, like myself, Nigel, Crump, Brent. So all joking aside, please come out, say hi to us. I'll be at the reg desk. So I'll be happy to see your faces come out. So please say hi.
Well, next up, Nemo 3 and the lightning immunity change.
So Brent, you're the resident Signar player. Why don't you walk us through the changes and tell us what your input is, like what your perception is and how you feel about it.
So, this change hit about noon on Friday of last week, and I had to drive home. So approximately 8 o'clock, I finally quit grinning from ear to ear. it was close though. So it's a twofold change. The first change is not as big as it sounds. Nemo has to have the enemy in his control area for his feat to work. Now his feat is an extra D6 for lightning damage. They've hinted that this is going to be how all plus damage buffs will be going forward. The net result is Nemo trades out Reinhold if he was running in Storm Division, or a random other solo if he was running in Heavy Metal, for a Squire, possibly. I've already played with Nemo since then. You may still keep Reinhold for the stealth removal. But all in all, he has to play a little further forward. He has to run a risk of dying. He can't hide behind a force, behind a building, behind three Storm Striders and the rest of your army to still work, but it's workable.
But he does have the ability to extend his control radius, right?
I don't believe Nemo 3 does. You're thinking of 2.
2. I'm thinking of 2.
All in all, I think it's a good change for the game. If, Ossian has the same effective feat, presumably Butcher 1 will, McKay does. Basically, if you get a damage buff, you've got to be forward.
That,
okay, I can live with that.
That almost craters Butcher.
because he was getting a lot of play to begin with, right?
Exactly, right, exactly. He was not getting play, so yeah. I hope he gets reworked.
I mean, you've already had your CID, so probably not.
You have to CID him to nerf him, right?
No. No, these changes are not going through CID. These are just announced, this will happen changes.
Oh, boo.
So that is actually that's actually one thing I kind of wanted to touch on before we jump over to the lightning immunity change, is that this is there's been a lot of conjecture about the nature of this change, and there's been a lot of people talking about how, like, well, it's CID, there's no guarantee. To my understanding, the dev team, specifically Pagani, came out and stated, this is going to happen. We're telling you this now, so that way you aren't caught off guard when you see it in the official release. Yeah. But this is not changing. This is not up for debate. This is just the way it's going to be moving forward. Is that correct?
Yes, they were repeatedly have said this is not a debatable point. This is not a testing point. This is when you do your testing, this is how it's going to work. So, and I mean, they've done it before. They've said that they're going to continue doing this type of errata without testing. They did it with Coven most recently.
That is true. That change never went through CID.
The second change I am really, really happy about and a little sad. Lightning will not arc off of lightning immune models. Now, in practice, this means that you have to actually shoot a target if you're playing Storm Division. You can't just run your Firefly or your Stormlands in and kill everything within 4 inches of it.
Oh, how terrible. How absolutely terrible.
It does not change that lightning will not arc to lightning immune models. So that's a misconception a lot of people had was, well, now it just jumps to the first guy and stops. Well, no, it never jumped to the first guy to begin with. Net result, Signar's going to have a little more trouble against stealth outside of Grave Diggers and possibly Storm Division. They're going to have to play a little bit more fair. Nemo's going to be looking at things like using a Centurion as an arc target instead. The big change is that on the one hand, I'm happy because now I don't have to worry about Nemo 3 in my Haley 3 pairing running a jack up and killing everything within 4 inches. The drawback being I now have to look at my Haley 3 mirror match and go, well, now what do I do? Because I can't just run a Stormlance up there and kill everything within 4 inches. So it's a positive, good change for the game. I have won multiple tournament games in the last year with this tactic in not Nemo 3, in Striker 2 usually, while looking at my opponent going, they need to fix this. But until they do, take those two guys die.
Well, sure, because it's not players' it's not the player's responsibility to balance the game, right? So I'm going to use the tools at my disposal to get me the cleanest and the best win that I can get in a manner that's going to progress me in tournament play, right? So if that means that I can arc off of my own lightning immune model to generate an assassination attempt from 20, 4 inches away or something after I force hammer my own jack forward after running it or whatever the case may be, like, I'm going to do that, right? Because that's what's going to get me the most equity in the win. That's what's going to get me there. So I can't really blame players for using that. But there is a distinct line between recognizing that it needed to be changed and just holding on to the concept that this is the way the game should be, because clearly this was generating some pretty frustrating game states. I know I've played against Nemo 3 a fair bit, quite a bit, and I know sometimes it really feels like there's just not a whole lot you can do, especially if you happen to have an army that wants to rely more on its defensive value than it does on its armor value. So specifically Circle has a huge problem with Nemo 3. Well, the living side of Circle has a huge problem with it.
So let me touch on two things there real quick. One, if you're dropping a list that relies on stealth relies on defense into Signar, you should rethink your list design just across
sure.
the board.
But there are factions where that is designed into their functionality, that they are going to rely heavier on their defensive value than they are on their armor stat. I mean, not every faction has 10-point arm 20, 32, 34 box models.
Correct. But you should be looking at dropping your bones list or your 6 Carnivian list or your whatever can absorb damage. If you're dropping defense into basically any Signar list, it's irrelevant.
Sure. I agree.
then the thing is, even after this, because of the way the Midwest meta is, I'm still looking very heavily at Nemo 3 as a very playable caster. It answers a current Signar problem I have, and it answers it neatly, and I like that, so we'll see.
So, because one of the things that we heard a lot when this change was originally announced is that these changes are going to put Nemo 3 on the shelf. It feels like those statements are probably made potentially a little prematurely. So you would probably agree with that statement then, right? Like, you would think
He's
probably still got plenty of game.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Is it possible? I mean, how bad does this affect the other casters in the stable?
Haley 2 loses a little bit with sniping out problem solos with the Fireflies. The Stormwall loses a little bit. The Storm Pod can't pick out problem solos. Striker 2, for those of you who haven't seen my Striker 2 list, I run between 2 and 5 Fireflies, depending on how the mood strikes me, and I clear off infantry, so now you can probably jam the infantry a little bit better. But I'm pretty certain for most of the stuff, it just changes the line of engagement, because you still kill every infantry model within 6 inches of a Storm Lance. Outside of those, I don't think you're nearly as bad off, and I think you're going to see some stuff actually come out that people weren't expecting to. For instance, Kray is shaping up to be a very viable caster. Haley 2 is obviously a very viable caster. Both of them like to run at least one Centurion. If I shoot a Centurion with Arcane Shield, which is very easy to get, with a Firefly or even with a Stormstrider, I mean, a Centurion, even in the back, is dice -7 on damage from a Stormstrider. That'll clear off everything around it. And then the Centurion can go deeper and not get charged.
Yeah.
It takes out your easy anti-stealth tactic, and it takes out your clear off your guy easier tactic. It still works.
What I think is really interesting about this is that I think with Nemo 3, with these changes to Nemo 3, I think it actually allows a lot of other things in the game to maybe to have like one more positive matchup now, or at least one more neutral matchup. For example, I keep thinking about Cold Grima. So without being able to ignore clouds anymore, effectively, unless you're running, you know, something up there and the ability for you to have to come forward a little bit, I think it really does change the dynamic of the game. And I think the same thing happens with Zirkova, Zirkova 1 anyway. So I think it's really interesting because the dynamic of how that game plays and potentially even the need for the model selection or even the list inside of a list pair changes pretty significantly now, especially if you play in a meta where there's a lot of Signar. So I'm actually, because I happen to play in one of those metas, as you well know. So what I think is really interesting is that it actually has forced me to kind of reconsider what my current Circle list pair is, because I don't feel like I just have to concede half of a matchup to Nemo 3.
I don't know. It's a weird, for me, you know, I'm a little out of the finger on the pulse, as you might say. I generally don't have a problem with Signar so much. I probably still find Krix to be a bigger boogeyman for me than Signar. All these nerfs, there's probably a lot of factions who are kind of like, huh? You know, like, why'd they need that? But, you know, because they don't, you know, Signar is not to say that Signar is not a problem and, like, they can't bring really awesome top-end lists. It's just those games are usually very competitive and enjoyable, and it's not a negative play experience, generally speaking, at least for me. But
does that answer your questions?
Yeah, it got mine answered.
Mm-hmm.
So the next topic we had after we talked about Nemo is so the juniors. They apparently now, Privateer Press came out today and clarified for us that they now get to bring their jacks that they have a bond with into whatever list that they're currently in, right? So used to be, you know, Warcasters or Warlocks, if they have a War Beast with a bond, they can include that in any theme force that you were playing them in. So the juniors kind of get that too, which is really interesting. And I know, Brent, you had a whole lot of thoughts on this, so take it away.
So this is a let's make it easier for new players and better quality of life change. The number of questions I get about, can I take Carib Disc with Iacos in Black Industries? Well, no, because Characters isn't in Black Industries. This just makes sense. I mean, they're bonded. They have their special jack or what have you. Already I've been brainstorming about what the best, what I'd want to run. And this dropped 10 hours ago. So we've had a lot of discussion back and forth. I'm going to go back to Signar because they're just basically the second best faction after Krix. Kane Zero is in Heavy Metal. Heavy Metal is Sloan's favorite list. Kane Zero can take Ace, which means that you can take your theme that rewards you for taking lots of jacks for her battle group, and now you've got a reliable source of Shadowfire. For perspective, if Sloan ever gets popular, you need to make sure you've got at least one shield guard in one of your lists. Otherwise, they will pick a target that's your screen your caster with, and then it will just quit mattering.
Or in some cases, four targets in front of your caster and ignore all four.
Only in Kane 3.
Hmm.
And they can't do that because it's Kane 0. But just adding one source of Shadowfire means I can ignore one Colossal or Battle Engine that's screening your caster, and that changes the math a lot. That was the first one that stuck out at me. The second one was I have no idea if Charybdis is good or not right now. I have some Krix friends who are very excited about it with the changes it got in CID. And you probably don't run it with Slayer Spam, Gatsby 3. I don't see any reason you would. But fitting it in with Denny 2, you lose access to Damnation for the extra charge and Pathfinder. But you can still incorporate it. And you've got a very long-range threatening jack every turn, as well as a Gunfighter Black Oil Spray. There's probably something you can do with that. I am assuming that somebody on this cast looked at implications for Sorcia Zero, though.
Sorcia Zero is awesome, period, unless she gets inevitably nerfed. But Beast of Nine is less exciting. Like, this 20-point turd you have to kite in, and then it's a shield guard, sure, which is kind of cool, but... Yeah, I don't know. It is fun to think about. It's also fun to think about the implications for the future, which is that there's really no reason. So basically, with these juniors, you kind of have the ability to kind of get shoehorn in more character jacks into tier lists that they weren't typically available because casters, a lot of the tier lists kind of...
Nigel, let me interrupt you for a moment. I suspect you didn't keep up with the last CID release cycle.
Why is that?
The Kador one.
The Manowar thing? Yeah. I kept up with it.
Beast 09 is down to 18 points.
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, he's still 18, so you're carrying in an 18-point. And she boundless charges it, and you can combo it with some things, but it's like, holy.
I thought it got another buff, but it looks like it just got cheaper.
Yeah. The Spriggan got all over the place. But, yeah, it sucks when you have to pay a lot of points for kind of a limited, you know. I don't know. It's tough. I mean, a Juggernaut versus Beast 09 is still a tough call.
Right, and that's why it's kind of hard when I look at Sorcia Zero. Like, I'm excited for Sorcia Zero because she does a lot of really cool stuff, like Boundless Charge of Fog of War is neat. but I look at that in the lens of, you know, I get to take Beast 09 into different lists now, and I thought about, like, well, what does that really mean? Like, well, maybe with Strakov it means something. Maybe with maybe in Jaws of the Wolf, certain builds may want to take advantage of that. Like, Kador, it's nice to have a shield guard handy.
Kador specifically... is almost entirely built around the idea that if it's not in your battle group, it's kind of trashy. Like, you have to really do some gymnastics to get value out of a beast or a jack that's not in your battle. So, like, Vlad 1, don't get the feet. You do get boundless charge and side supports, and that's great. But not getting the 2x your speed is rough. Not getting, you know, with, you know, strangely, Sorcia 1 is one of the people who can actually run, you know, Jack Marshall's in her... She's not list dependent on things being in her battle group, but then you can't obviously take Sorcia Junior. There's just it's amazing how so many scornages there are. Now Strakov is one that's kind of a mixed bag because they do benefit from his feet, get +4 inches of threat on Beast 09 with Boundless Charge. That's still spectacular, but no overrun is brutal.
I really want to dig out my remaining Kador jacks and just play Strakov 1 a bunch. So
yeah. Oh, no, he's amazing. Strakov 1, I think he's criminally underrated in every theme. Like, you could play him in Winter Guard, Jaws of the Wolf, and in Wolves of Winter. And actually, you could play him in Legion of Steel. Like, you could literally play him in any theme, and he's got spectacular sort of synergies with it that aren't exactly obvious, mostly because his gimmick is super obvious, and he just hits you in the face with that. But so many of those tier lists have unintended sort of bonuses for him.
Well, and truth to be told, when it comes to Strakov, if you haven't seen him work yet, or if you've never sat across the table from him, you have no idea. Like, someone can tell you, watch out, because he can make his jacks threaten the table. But until you actually see that happen, it's really hard to conceptualize that. Like, well, it's really hard.
It's worse than that. I mean, so like me and Josh, Josh is probably my most regular opponent, and then we'll rack up like 4 or 5 games or whatever in a row. And we, you know, sometimes they're only like 15-minute games because we just rack up to the point where they're walking into an assassination or whatever. And Strakov's one of those guys that's like, I really want to play him and I want to practice him, but it's tough because he just ends the game. And like we get ourselves in a game state where I get to go first. I'll move up. Then he'll move and I'll say like, well, I'm going to kill your caster. And then we kind of run through the numbers and like, okay, you just killed my caster. So then we let him reposition. Okay, I kill your caster anyways. He repositions. Okay, I killed your caster anyways. Okay, let's pretend that I go second. And then he goes first. And then I go. And then he goes. And I'm like, okay, I got to kill your caster. And then we're still like, you don't get the play as hard as you think about it. You still can't work around what he's doing sometimes. It's like really irritatingly difficult. And then you get to the point, you know, Josh is pretty experienced, kind of gets like frustrated, like, can we just play like a... You know, can I, like, just play a different caster, essentially, that plays the game more conventionally? And that's a rewarding feeling when you're a Kador player, to be like, yeah.
And,
yeah, I want Brent to play him. I think that would be spectacular. I think Kador was one of those factions. There's probably, I think every faction suffers from this to a little bit, is that they're just not attractive to the top-end players, because top-end players tend to play things that have been play-tested. Like, you know, they kind of go where... Who's the Signar player in England who wins everything?
Dunford.
Yeah, Dunford. They like follow, you know, they go where Dunford goes, or they go where Banky goes, or they go where, you know, things are constantly kind of being boiled down to the points that they're willing to play, you know, in a sort of conventional wisdom. Then some factions are outside of that, you know, sort of focus.
Well, I don't want to, at the risk of taking that topic and kind of digressing into something else, but I'm going to do it anyway. So the thing about it is that I think that's where the expectation of performance and the expectation of what you're playing needs to happen, right? So one of the biggest arguments that I always hear online, it comes up every week. Every week you can hop onto the Facebook forums or you can go to whatever Reddit you want to hit. And every week there's a comment about how is X faction viable, right? And, you know, every week I'll see a statement. Every week I will reply, yeah, there's nothing wrong with it. Last time I engaged in this statement was, is Kador competitive? Well, my reaction was yes, Kador is still competitive. Like, Kador's fine. Kador is a fine faction. They're good. They do a lot of cool stuff. There's lots of, you know, neat things that you can use in the faction. They play big stompy robots like No Tomorrow. Like, there's a lot of good reasons to play. Now, of course, the natural argument to that is that people will be like, well, if they're so competitive, then why did X player switch from them to Crix? Or why do we not see them more often in the top tables? Well, there's a couple of thoughts I have about that. But the first one, and probably the most important one, is that you are going to play to the level of your competition. And so if the level of your competition are your local guys or your local, like your extended area. So like for me, I'm in Joplin. So my local competition, I would consider like Springdale, Arkansas, Kansas City, Des Moines on an extended trip. Like, I would consider those like my extended local area, right? So when I go to play in a tournament in Springdale or I go to play in a tournament in Kansas City, like the difference between whether or not I win or lose that game is not measured in the power level of my faction. It's measured in how well I played. And so I would imagine, you know, maybe when you get up to the top, you know, 3% of players in the world, sure, there's an argument to be made for power level of faction and functionality. But when we talk about, like, you know, is Kador good or you know, can Kador compete? And then you look at things like Strakov and you look at things like Strakov 2 and you're like, no, there's like lots of depth in this faction. There's lots of cool things you can do. Like, it's all about the level of competition that you intend to compete at. If I'm going to play in a local steamroller in Joplin that gets, you know, 8 to 10 players or sometimes 12 if we're lucky, if I'm going to play in that steamroller, I don't have to worry about every player in the WTC showing up at my tournament, right? Like, I just need to worry about playing against the people that I know are going to be there, and I can have a perfectly reasonable list pair that can do that.
That's one
aspect.
It
doesn't matter what faction I play.
Yeah, but it does, because if your goal is to play War Machine Weekend, you need to accommodate, you need to play against your A players with a list that's going to be relevant at War Machine Weekend. So it's like, on one hand, yeah, playing based on the meta you know is one thing, but then, you know, if you're playing, if you're preparing for a larger sort of, you know, I don't think, like, Brent has any time to waste, right? Goofing off. He's got bigger things he's prepping for.
My goof-off list is normally Nemo 3.
Right, and first off, that doesn't make you funny. That just makes you a terrible person. Other side to that is...
I wasn't joking. That's the worst part.
I know so much. But the other side to it is like, that's where the expectation of performance comes in, right? So, you know, if I want to hit War Machine Weekend, if I want to play in that upper echelon, then obviously, yeah, I've got to pay a lot more attention. And my list construction needs to probably, whether I intend it to or it just happens through Genesis, it is probably going to look very similar to traditional list design that we see from a lot of extremely successful players. Because at the end of the day, like, if we're practicing the same games and we're practicing against the same stuff, chances are the same solutions are probably going to start showing up, right? But that goes back to the expectation. If you're just wanting to play in, like, a local steamroller, you're like, hey, look, are these guys competitive enough? Can I take this to my local steamroller and play? Yes, you can. You absolutely can. Like, I don't know. I'm sorry. At the risk of digressing into a separate topic, that to hear that stated, I think it's a point that's worth making, especially when we talk about casters like Strakov and things that you don't normally see in the faction.
I will say the Strakov is his flaw is that he's situationally easy to play. I mean, he's like a noob destroyer. He's absolutely like a gear check for people just understanding the game. But yeah, he can be, you know, Haley 3-esque, annoyingly difficult to play on your side of the table, like wrapping your head around his threat vectors, not going into the tank every turn, you know, not being too enamored with trying to assassinate literally every turn, understanding the math on assassinations. And also, when your game plan is that narrow, you just lose because of dice sometimes. Like, I've definitely lost because I had a murderous Beast 09. It was actually a Beast 09 and a Spriggan on Grim 2, I believe. And he was behind a wall. And I just didn't kill him. Like, it was just like, well, he had 3 fury, but I had, like, I got past the wall because my threat range is so extreme, and I think I even had him knocked down. And it was a Beast 09 and a Grolar, sorry, and he was knocked down and I failed to kill him, and that was basically that. I was like, well, that's my game. Things happen because you miss a couple of attacks because, you know, some are over the wall and some aren't, and I don't know. You pare your game down to 6 attacks, and half of which are superiority and not a lot of boosting. You know, dice can become very critical, like really bad. Whereas, like with Nemo, he's just spreading love all over the place and exploding. And you're sort of like, "Wee, I'm playing in the dice redundancy playhouse."
Fair enough. So sorry to take us dramatically off topic there. I wanted to kind of explore that when you said it.
Oh yeah, yeah. But I do wish that, like, there are good players out there I wish would, like, champion. I've always tried to. That's kind of like what I like about like guys like Alex Cosmo, who just play whatever they want to play and then champion it. And then, you know, they'll have years where they're kind of honed in and years where they're not, as they have to, like, you know, they're sort of trying to constantly experiment and figure things out. But that's sort of the fun of it, too, sort of the different path.
Yeah, and I think also, too, it's pretty cool to just watch, like, the change or the adaptation of, like, that player as they move, like, through event to event to event. And you kind of just see, like, their list change and, like, the concepts change. It's really cool. It's nice to have a champion. Like, not every faction gets a Jake Van Meter. Not every faction gets, you know, a Keith Christensen. Not every faction gets a Pat Dumford or Brent Simon or, like, Michael Ireland. Like, not every faction gets,
Did you just name Signar 4 times in a row?
I think I just did. I mean, kind of, I guess. Maybe Keith's playing Crix, so I guess technically not. But or at least the last time I knew he was. I don't know who he's playing now, but... but anyways, though, like, not every faction, like, obviously gets, like, a champion, right? Like, Brett Fogel's champion minions right now. So it's really cool because you get to, like, watch them. Like, you get to watch, like, Brett, like, go from, like, okay, this is a really cool list. And then, like, you see him and he plays, and you kind of watch him play, and I got to see him play at the ATC and, you know, some really close games, and then the LVO and some really close games, and then he brings down Adepticon, you know? And so it's really cool because you get to see that progression. So it's really exciting. And if you're a part of that faction, that's super cool because you get to be like, oh, I see where he did that, or, oh, I get it. Now I understand why that's in the list. So it's really cool to have those champions. I wish we had more. And there's a lot of factions that definitely, like, we have those, like, obviously Trolls. And Trolls has John Henry Jr. and Chris Dancox. Those guys are amazing, right? Like, so there's all kinds of, like, really cool champions out there. So I wish every faction had them.
I would like to point out, by the way, as we try to get back on the actual topic, there is a fourth junior. We didn't forget the Crix players. Your fourth junior is Iacos, maybe next CID. If you haven't seen the changes to Denny 1, she's still... She will be able to deliver Parasite with her one arc node, which is probably the jack you take with her. But she doesn't – you're probably running her in Black Industries, and she doesn't work with the top three Black Industries casters super well.
What about Nightmare?
Yeah, that is a good point. Like, being able to bring Nightmare with her may – like, that might be really interesting, right?
You can fit in an overpriced Seether if you want, I guess.
Whoa, Nightmare's cool, though. Is he, like, is that the general consensus, is that he's just kind of like an overpriced Seether? Because I always thought he was really cool. Like, I thought he had, like, cool abilities.
He's ghostly and stealthy and prey, and I mean, he's also, I'm double checking, I want to say he's 18 points.
That sounds about right.
Yeah, 18 points for a Seether with prey, ghostly, and bonded stealth, and losing countercharge. So that's a lot of for 5 points. Five points is a lot.
5 points is a lot, but that's not for nothing. Like, stealth is not for nothing. Prey is not for nothing.
And it's a melee jack, which means you're going to either not have focus for it next turn, or Denny's 8 inches away.
Well, that's okay. That's fair. That's a fair statement. That's a good point.
At the end of the day, that's the easiest way to shut down that 20-point jack for Sorsha or Denny is going to be the 5-box model next to it. So.
Sure. Yeah, that's fair. That's kind of disappointing, I guess, when you think about it like that. But it is very true. Like, if I saw it across the table, first thing I tried to do is kill a junior, so I didn't have to deal with the jack.
Okay. So what's next on the agenda?
All right. Well, the last topic I really had today was written in. How do you handle or how do you play against someone who outthreats you considerably? Right. So I kind of wanted to touch on this because. I think it's a really interesting topic. There's obviously a lot of threads that this can go down, but I kind of wanted to pose the question to both of you and get your feedback on it. As a troll player and as a Kator player, it's not uncommon that I'm out-threaded by significant margins. You know, when Juggernaut threatens 8 inches unassisted, you know, every speed 5 heavy in the game is going to out-threat you, and there's a lot of speed 5 heavies out there. And that's assuming they don't have any help too. So whether you're talking about being out-threaded by, you know, a couple inches, which is probably easier to mitigate, or you're talking about being out-threaded by a massive range, like, how do you handle that? How do you keep yourself in that game without losing on scenario, but without giving away your entire army?
So one, I'd like to take a point to point out that it feels like the game is shifting toward much more piece trading than it used to be in the past. There's one list in the game I think I can come up with that could reliably take a charge and counterattack, and that's minions in one specific build. So if your plan is I'm going to get punched in the face and then I'm going to destroy whatever punched me in the face, that works, but realize you're always going to be down that unit. So maybe look at your list design. Even Kator can threaten. I mean, you can put Ulans, what, 13 inches, 15 inches? I got no idea, Nigel. Ulans for days. Second thing, so I was faced with this weekend where my opponent threatened roughly 22 inches with their caster, and I only threatened about 15 with mine, but I could jam so he couldn't reliably get all 22. So realistically, he out-threatened me by a couple inches, which is basically the entire world when you're dealing with an incorporeal caster. I got around it by using things like cloud, terrain. I was playing Siege, too. Because I was playing Siege, who has three different methods of movement during his activation, one of which is a place. I was able to put down things like rocket pods and walls so I couldn't be hellmouthed over them. I was able to be far enough back that if I had a wall, I could be far enough back that he couldn't actually charge me against the wall and connect. Figure out what your win condition is. If your opponent out-threats you with guns, unless they're AoEs or E-leaps, probably your win condition is run straight forward, because otherwise you're just losing models every turn. Figure out if your win condition is clocking. We touched that last week. See if there's anything you could do to mitigate it. An amazing example I heard about years back was Flanzer playing Runes of War in Mark II, and he had the, I want to say it was four Rune Shaper build, and he drew an opponent which could trivially deal with the Rune Shapers, but the Rune Shapers would be a scenario path to victory for him, and had much more trouble dealing with the heavies. So if you played against Rune Shapers in Mark II, every game was basically, I screen my heavies with these tough, no-knockdown, five-box guys that just don't die, and you can't run past them. And what Flanzer ended up doing was deploying his heavies to basically screen his infantry. No one had done that before, and his opponent looked at the deployment and went, this game just changed entirely. And he pulled out a scenario win because of it, because he was able to use the infantry in the opposite way of what they were expected to secure that win. I played against a Dini 1 player at Adepticon with Siege. I out-threatened him on one turn. He out-threatened me on the rest of the turns, mm-hmm. because he was playing Scourge Dini 1. So we went back and forth, but I realized that while I've got a lot of short-range guns that don't ignore stealth, my path to victory was I'm going to put a triumph shot into your caster's face every turn. And turns out that's a really good plan against Dini 1. I recommend it highly. You're hitting on nines, and you're doing dice plus on boosted. To the extent that my opponent actually spent his post-feet turn running as far from Triumph as he could to the back corner of the kill box to not lose in scenario. Look for, do you have any outs like that? I have heard of Madrak 1 players using Wrathrock off of an objective to just put a bunch of damage on a caster, and realize they're not going to kill that caster that way, but all of a sudden, that caster now has to stay further back to not get shot in the face again, and maybe it keeps their personal threat or their buffs out of the game, so you can pull yourself back in that way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or either play Skari 1 or Lucant or someone else with an armor feat where you can just run up and pop your armor feat and jam, or play Signar. We threat for days.
Mm-hmm. Doomy 3.
Dini 2, Haley 2, Kray 1. You know, play some of the casters with the 17-inch charge ranges. I'm confident your faction has one. Almost across the board.
I know when we talk about dealing with being out-threaded, something that I could probably offer, or something that I want to offer to the conversation is, sometimes you have to kind of look at things and accept the fact that losses are inevitable, and you're going to have to put something forward at some point anyway. And that goes back to peace trading, and it's all about starting that peace trade and understanding that, like you said earlier, you know, if I put this out there, I'm going to lose it. And the question then becomes, can I still win the game without whatever it is I'm putting out there? A lot of people, I think, sometimes get nervous, and so they'll put out, like, this big heavy armor piece, like Behemoth or something, thinking that, like, it's going to be really hard to bring down, and then they lose it, and they realize it was, you know, it was a linchpin in their army, right? That was the anchor that they were going to pivot against. So you have to be careful about what you're trying to peace trade with, but you're going to have to accept the fact that you're going to have to put something in zones that's going to not let you lose on scenario, but you're also going to have to put stuff out there to get them to come in, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you've got, as an example, if you've got a round circle, your zone on your right, if you put one or two models in it, and I'm playing Signar, I'll just shoot each one with a express team, and now they're no longer in the zone. 95% of the time. So you've got to commit with enough that I have to put actual resources in as opposed to taking two random shots, but not so much that you lose everything you care about. And that's kind of a balancing act.
Yeah. Most
yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead, Nigel.
Yeah, most of it's just sort of gaming, sort of the gaming 101. I don't know. I know that a lot of gamers have had sort of this experience where, and again, this the question was specifically if they have a big advantage over you, but there's sort of that. I've had a game where I had a 1-inch advantage over my opponent, and my opponent, despite, there's a way to not counter. He would run up his models. I had an 11-inch threat, Pikeman with reach or whatever, and he moved his models within 11.5 inches, so I couldn't reach him. And then I just observed that he was not in my, he was not in scenario, and neither was I. Neither of us were going to win on scenario, but I had like a behemoth and some other things that could just shoot him. So I was like, well, I'm not going to move, and I'm just going to sit here and we'll reset, you know, like you have to run and engage me, buddy. Like you can't just, you know, but that's part of the, like, if you know, I don't know if you have the advantage, force them to play into it. Don't let cagey dudes just, you know, try to trick you into like running into their melee ranges.
So go ahead.
No, carry on.
I think what you're saying is if you built your list also with 3 units of shield guard guys and no range extenders and no ranged attacks and no arc nodes, and your entire goal is I'm going to walk these guys forward and get punched in the face, you probably, A, failed at list design.
Yep.
B, you're going to get punched in the face, and eventually you'll play somebody who can take everything off without committing anything. So you really should look at some minimum level of threat projection outside of just, I'm going to walk these guys up the board and look at you.
Yeah.
Because you have behemoth.
Go ahead, Nigel.
Oh, yeah. Because you can just lose a game. Like, a good list builder, the first thing a good list builder does is have one way to project some threat. Your whole list can't have the same static threat. So, like, every list I ever make ever since the dawn of time, and this may just be a Kador thing, I don't know, but I have at least the behemoth or Widowmakers or something to project a threat of table so that the opponent doesn't get rewarded for just making me run into them. Like, that's just impossible.
Well, and I was going to kind of chime into that same effect. Like, that's where list construction is extremely important. Like, we have a tendency, I think a lot of players, myself included, like when I say this, it's not like I'm above the curve or anything. Like, I do it too. Like, I think we have a tendency to look at when we're list building and we're like, oh, this model's really sweet. I'll keep hitting the plus button till it turns red, right? But we don't necessarily think sometimes about the value or the importance of having something that can project threat, so that way we're not just stuck in a situation where we can't, like, we are literally at the mercy of the other guy. And even if you can't match them with the exact same threat ranges, so Behemoth is going to threaten 18 inches on his bombard. That's a healthy range, no doubt, but it's not going to match the, 21-inch threat range off of a Stormstrider or whatever. The point is that even if you can't get, like, complete parity in threat ranges, you still need a couple of pieces that, even if situationally, are going to allow you to project enough threat to cover an area, to control that area, like a zone, or they're going to give you enough threat to where the unit, the piece that he's put in there to try and hold that area from you or to take it from you, you're going to, like, you still need something to be able to convince him that he's going to have to move that piece forward and engage, or you're going to sit there and shoot it to pieces, right? And you still have to have something that actually allows you to do that. And I think sometimes that's and this goes back to more list building philosophy, but I think that sometimes that's something that we miss. I think that's something that players sometimes overlook when they're building their lists. And we're like, well, like, it's only one gun. How good is one gun, right? Like, I'm not building a gun line, so I don't need guns, right? Mm-hmm. Well, come to find out, if you're playing a bunch of Kador Jacks, having Behemoth in that list, really good. A pair of bombards that hit hard, that threaten a good range, it's really good when everything else in your list threatens 8 inches. 11 if you trigger Warpath or what have you.
I've seen games where their only threat projection was Cal Baloch, and that was enough. Like, there's, depending on how your list is constructed and what you're doing and your plan is, but you should have just something that has the ability to just tickle their butthole, you know, ambushing troops, extreme, you know, charges, just stuff like that. The other thing to watch out for is, so, like, say you're being out-threaded by your opponent and you have to do the unenviable task of forcing the action. there's sort of a no man's land of positioning that people get caught in, and it actually takes a bit of practice. And then again, feel free, guys, to interject when you want with your own experiences or whatever. But generally speaking, say you have a 10-man unit, you're being out threaded by 3 or 4 inches. You have to position. I'll divide them up. I'll say 4 models are going to act as a screener for the other 6. This is like the earliest version of your sort of peace trade concept, which would be. Sometimes you'll have a whole unit of screeners for a unit of champions or something like that, more involved multi-piece. But even one unit can screen for itself with just good placement with coherency. The problem with that is that you want to, because they out-threat you by so much, that your back row has to really be cognizant of being too far back so that your screeners can't be removed without your back row not being able to respond. So that would be the other thing to watch out for. So being extremely out-threaded is just a competitive advantage that if you're giving it up, you're just in a bad spot. Like, so yeah, you have to, again, start looking for your other win conditions, the clocking them out, winning, you know, bullying just one, ending on turn 7 with one more scenario point, you know, realistically, yeah, just start.
Well, and much to that point too, like I always think back to like Iron Fang Pikemen, because they're a unit that is, or Femblades, because they're both units that do this really well. When you talk about a unit screening for themselves, like it's really easy to take, 4 Iron Fang Pikemen and put them out front, especially if there's a piece of terrain or something that's intervening, to where the 4 that you put out front can't get shot because of positioning. And so if they're going to send something in, they're going to have to piece trade on those first 4. And then the rest of them you can put in shield wall behind if you need to, or you can iron zeal or you, whatever the case may be, but you can kind of play them a little bit more defensively. And then also, you know, when you're talking about that back rank, something that I always try to remember, and this is really important with Femblades, is that don't discount the need to use a threat range extender or a mini feed or something like that to get that back row engaged. Especially if your opponent's not counting on it. Like something that I did often was that I would run my Femblades forward. My opponent would come crashing into my Femblades. They'd kill the 4 that I put out front. And then I would have like my second rank of like 3 or 4 dudes. And then I would have the back rank of another 3 or 4 dudes. And so they would come in, they'd kill that front rank. There'd be my second rank and they'd be ready. And then I would, you know, and I think they would look at the table and be like, well, even if they charge me, he's only going to get 4 of them on me. And then that's true if I didn't use my mini feet, but I'm going to go ahead and use my mini feet now because it's worth it for me to be able to press that advantage, knowing that you potentially are going to give away a much more expensive piece to get 4 Femblades off the table. And I've seen the same thing with, like Old Witch too. Something that I did the exact same thing. I put like 4 Iron Fang Pikemen out front, 3 Iron Fang Pikemen and my standard bear, to be perfectly honest. Cause screw that guy. So there's the 3 of them out front. My opponent comes in, beats him up. He looks at my table and he's like, well, I think you can only get 3 charges on me. And then I'm like, okay, well, it's my turn. So let's talk about this. So I switch over with Old Witch 2. I use her ability. I use her ability to reduce the cost of a spell by 1. And so I was able to boundless charge like 3 more Iron Fang Pikemen. And so the resulting charges were enough to pick up a heavy. So he essentially ended up trading because he's not being cognitive. And he kind of, even though he out-threaded me, I was still able to get him to come into me because I could put that force up front. And then when he came into me, I was able to use my own list and the synergies inside of my own list to be able to do that crackback. And when that happens, he trades a 14, a 16-point heavy for, you know, 5.5, 6 points worth of dudes.
Yeah, I mean, that's... Yeah. That's part of what you're trying to trick your opponent. Good opponents won't be tricked. Well, sometimes sure. They do. Some actually, the magic happens to everybody eventually, occasionally. Because, yeah, I've definitely had a few really good players accidentally walk into some absolute jank. But I don't know if it's reliable. That gap, that screen gap I was referring to, it gets defeated by so many bizarre things that, I mean, I've definitely positioned my own guys where it's like the front row got removed. And then in that gap, a cloud wall landed, you know, and then I can walk my guys forward, but I can't really meaningfully do that much. And that's miserable, you know, when they take just something for free, give you almost nothing, and then you have to kind of re-slog back into them. That can be that's also just demoralizing. Like, it can just suck the game out from under you.
Well, sure. And that's where you have to be careful about falling for the magic, right? So, and I'm not saying that you always want to play to, like, I'm not saying that it's particularly a good idea to invest, you know, three boundless charges into three Iron Fang pikemen so you can get back into the game. Straight out of them.
It's just you can't guarantee that your opponent won't take that into account. Like, they'll be like, oh, so you can cast, you know, six boundless charges or seven boundless charges. Let's just, you know, if they just position themselves 2 more inches conservatively after removing your models, then you're like, I've, like, lost, you know, nothing. I haven't been crippled or anything, but I did lose it for nothing, basically. It's like, oh, it's
right.
A big game difference. So you have to, yeah, you're just trying to position it in such a way that you do trade up somehow, which can be tough if they're the type of player whose list idea is to out-threat the bejesus out of you. It can be hard to trick them because that's their whole point, is like, I've got a 17-inch threat, you have an 11-inch threat. I'm going to abuse my advantage, you know. I mean, the game is going to be about my advantage, and there's nothing you can do about it, save for, again, some of those other outs that we were talking about.
Well, and I think it's also, to kind of go down that path, something else that probably needs to be mentioned is that sometimes it is just best just to run. Sometimes it's best just to run and try and tie up that gun, right? Sometimes you just need to get up there, and that's part of the peace trade, is I'm going to throw away these six Iron Fang pikemen so they can just run and engage. And it sucks because I'm going to lose half a unit doing that, and so I have to make it worth it. But sometimes you have to accept that as being part of the out of being outranged, and then just accept the fact that, like, I'm going to have to get up there, and it's going to cost me a lot. But hopefully, once I get up there, the natural efficacy of my melee units are going to start taking over your guns, right? Because, you know, trench or long gunners aren't known for their ability to kill Iron Fang pikemen in melee. Like, it just doesn't happen very often, or whatever the case may be. I'm using that as a generalism. But the other thing also to kind of mention is, like, I also feel like inside of this whole conversation, there's an ability that's rarely – I see it forgotten about all the time. And sometimes I don't even see people just – they'll go entire games without using it. And it makes such a huge difference in this, is don't forget your reposition. Like, don't forget reposition. Like, especially, like, after, like, being able to charge and then complete a charge, and then maybe only one or two guys get to complete a charge because the rest of the unit's behind them, and then, like, they kill or whatever, and then you can reposition into another model to tie them up to buy you a little bit more space. Like, it also – and I know that sounds, like, really silly and really basic, but I see that a lot. People will forget that a model has reposition, and then they potentially have given up ground for no good reason, or they'll take extra shots that they shouldn't have taken because they forgot about reposition.
Well, a lot of times they don't forget. They just don't use it properly. Like, they – rather than taking those pikemen and re-engaging deeper, they'll – fall back and get in a shield wall or something. You know, sometimes the move isn't totally obvious. Usually it's sort of the sign of a player that just needs to experience some things. But
well, on that, yeah, sure.
But I do see that all the time where people, as I'm on the defending of it, I'm like worried about their reposition. Like, oh, they're going to muck things way up. And then they reposition in some way. That makes, you know, I understand what their point was, but then I'm like, okay. Yeah. Repositioning to get within 4 inches of that flag was not nearly as important as repositioning to block my charge on your caster. So while I appreciate that you've extended the scenario, it's not going to work out. Like, it's, yeah.
Well, and I've seen the same thing with, like, someone will come forward, they'll get some charges in, they'll reposition, like, many feet. Or something else I've seen happen a lot, too, is where, like, if you have reposition built into a mini feat, which there are several mini feats in the game that do, they'll come forward, but maybe they can only connect with, like, two or three guys. So they don't want to burn the reposition. They don't want to burn the mini feat to give, like, two or three guys reposition. Like, they just don't want to do that because they feel like it's a waste. But sometimes that is absolutely the best play, right? Mm. Especially if you're like, well, I have these three guys with, you know, 2-inch melee range, and I can tie up this entire unit of guns, you know, or at least can make my opponent contort their order of activations to deal with them. So it probably actually is the right play to go ahead and use that mini feat or to use that reposition to get there. And I think that's also something that probably should be mentioned.
Hmm. I also like the list that some has also as a Kador player. Kador actually has a good array of threat projection. But sometimes it's not the threat projection. It's just the table hogging that's hilarious. Like, both Vlad 1 and Vlad 2 are sort of my favorites. And that is oh, geez, it's Signar. They sure out-threat me. Okay, I'm going to feed on these two Dracoons and four Doom Reavers and literally just run and engage their front line. And then it's you've wasted your feet, but it's never a waste. It's not a waste. It's absolutely the right move. It always tilts them, and it's, you know, amazing. Like, yeah, it's like my hobby. Also, you know, the Harkovich and then the Vlad one with Jax is just, you know, most of the time you're just trying to get out from under the shade or get out of the shade of the bullets and get into their sweet, sweet, creamy nougat. So, yeah, make a list that does that.
Yeah, and it's also worth noting, too, that this is an incredibly complex topic. Like, it's really hard to look at this topic in a vacuum and just be like, you should do this or you should do that, because there's a lot of layers to it, right? And there's a lot of ways that you can unpack this question. I think when you look at it holistically, just dealing with, like, the general scenario, like, the things that we've talked about, specifically, like, getting things in there, understanding you're going to take losses, you know, being able to understand how peace trading works, having a ranged element or something that can project threat. I think, like, if you follow, like, some of these basic things, not only your basic list composition may actually change a little bit, which isn't a bad thing. That's probably a good thing, because trying new things is good. But also, you might actually find yourself, maybe you're not as good into a particular matchup as you once were, but you might be way better into a lot more matchups down the road, and that's ultimately what you're hunting for, right? So,
yeah. Back to Brent's point, right at kind of the opening, and this was not his point. I'm just paraphrasing it and then hijacking it and then recycling it into a different thing. But that if you're if you don't have a plan that's obvious because you're being threatened, then your list, just from the inception, when you were making it in the first place, probably went horribly wrong. Like, you had some neat things, and then you might not have actually thought about, because extreme threat is just one of those things that just every list you have to take into account, that might be what you're up against. So it's like, it might just be Thyra with Daughter Cav, you know, like, if you, like, what are you being out-threatened by that you need to have a game plan around? But, I mean, every list, if there's a reason why, if you're being out threatened by, you know, 4+ inches, there had better be a list design reason that happened, you know, like, it's Doom Shaper 3 and you don't care or whatever. But
and for perspective, most heavies I see, most players can slingshot a heavy equivalent 12 inches or bringing Cav or super fast infantry that threaten in the 14 to 15 inch range. So I don't know what your definition of extreme threat is. That will vary by person, but you should expect guns to threaten you from realistically 18 to 20 inches after they walk. You should expect heavies to be able to be slingshotted across the board. You should expect Cav to be on you.
Yeah, and there's also the phenomenon that kind of comes with that of how, like, after turn two, how important is range? And it's obviously still important. I'm not saying it's not. But after turn two, your engagement ranges get so close, typically, that while you will still have elements that are projecting threat a fair distance because they're going to be in the back and they're going to be affecting the front line or whatever, a lot of times, especially in combined arms lists or more melee-centric lists with a couple of guns, you find out that those ranges close fast. They close very fast. So at some point, you know, you don't necessarily have to gear every selection in your list to be able to outthreat your opponent. You just have to be able to live long enough to get to that point and then let the game work and let your models do what they're supposed to do and play it well. I'm sorry, go ahead, Brent.
I'm sorry. Now, if you find that you're getting outshot, outthreatened, and outfought when you get there,
sure, then you're just playing against Haley 3.
You should probably pick up Signar because it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's when you know you're playing against Haley 3. It's fine. It's completely fine. Everybody goes through this.
Scott, you need to come down tomorrow and you need to see what Siege 2 does.
I know. I've seen some battle reports. I've read some battle reports. I have a local Signar player. He's expressed some interest in Siege 2. And I've always thought Siege 2 is really cool. Colin brought him to a tournament once, and I watched him play a game with him. And I was like, oh, this is freaking sweet. You know, like, this is awesome. So I'm looking forward to seeing him kind of learn Siege 2.
I think it's a weird world that we live in. Colin's, his main is Kray and Siege 2. That's all he'll play. And then that might actually be competitive. It's like sort of up is down, cats and dogs living together.
You think that's weird? I was legitimately looking at building Haley 2 for my Crix drop the other day.
Hmm.
Because I was seeing a lot of Crix with 6 to 12 relevant models, and Haley 2 would be really happy with that.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, she would. Oh, just, wow.
But what kind of world are we in when I need something to deal with 6 to 12 heavies in my Crix drop? Crix,
yeah. In your Crix drop, yeah. But you know what, though? Like, there's an interesting argument. There's an interesting discussion, actually, around it's really around list building. And maybe this will be a good topic to table. And I know some listeners have suggested going into this. But, we do live in a weird world. We do. We live in a world where Crix brings heavies and infantry, of course. We live in a world where Kador is playing a lot more combined arms-ish kind of stuff. They're not just spamming dudes, or they're not just spamming jacks. We live in a world where Warpwolf Stalkers aren't as good as Wold Wardens, question mark. And in a world where Kolgrimma and Madrak 1 are common names in the Troll World. I mean, the point I'm trying to make is that things are kind of weird right now, right? So how do you build a list pair now? And I think maybe that'd be a really cool topic to kind of jump into sometime, is just to talk about, like, well, there's not the boogeymen that used to exist. Like, 2 years ago when Mark III launched, you had to have an answer for Wormwood. You had to have an answer for Madrak II. You had to have an answer for Sloan, right? Like, they were just boogeymen. You could also say the same thing about High Reclaimer.
All those guys are still boogeymen, and they still exist, and they're still exactly the same problem. It was just they got chased around, you know. Marauder spam chased some of those out, or some of the other things so solved them completely that they had no place to play. And now those things have been solved, so you see some of those problem children probably creeping back.
Yeah, absolutely, right? So, and it's...
I've been looking at Sloan lately, to be honest.
I hate Sloan. And... she's the worst for Kador, by the way.
Oh, I know, right? I hate Sloan in general. I just... ugh. But it's really fascinating, though, because we're sitting here and we're talking about this list design. And, I mean, you're absolutely right. Boogeymen still do exist. There's no question about that. But they've all been worked around. Like, they have either been errated, they've been changed, or the answers have just been discovered. And so, and it kind of made me think about that, because when we were talking about Lich 3, or we were talking about Crix bringing multiple heavies and Haley 2 being an answer, you know, when Haley 2 got nerfed, everybody was like, you know, she's not everybody, obviously, but a great many Signar players were like, she's completely useless now. And then here I am looking back at it. I'm like, yeah, no, that's still really good. Like, she's still probably a kick in the teeth to those lists. So just kind of how, I don't know, it'd be a cool topic to get into about how do you build a list in an environment? How do you build a list pair in an environment where there are boogeymen, but the boogeymen aren't really the boogeymen anymore, and the new boogeymen aren't really boogeymen to them anymore? So everybody just boogies around, right? And that's probably the worst way to describe that I've ever said in my life, and I'm ashamed to use that level of parlance. But
well, our
ashamed for you.
Hmm.
Yeah,
I'm helpful.
I know, Brent. I appreciate it so much.
Yeah, it's getting to the point where is just simply dodging a strategy everybody employs.
I mean, that was a strategy in Mark II. I remember talking to Nick a couple of times where his strategy was dodge Lilith II.
Yeah.
As long as I don't draw a Legion, or if I do, they aren't playing Lilith II, so, you know, he was fine.
I mean, there's so many things out there in the game, and there's so many great lists, you know? Like, it's, like, you can't cover it all. You can't. I was talking to a buddy of mine that plays Grimkin, and he loves Grimkin, and he loves Old Witch 2, and he loves piggybacks. Like, he loves that combination of the recursion of the piggybacks with Old Witch 2 and Sprint and the Blind Gun and all the cool stuff that it does. And he's like, I just can't play the list. The list is unplayable. I'm like, why is it unplayable? And he's like, well, I can't play it because if they have any kind of RFP, then I just, like, my game plan goes down the toilet. And I'm like, well, but why are you so scared of RFP being everywhere? And he's like, well, Band of Heroes. And I'm like, how many, like, you know, like, you're not going to go to an event where there's 9 troll players and one of every other faction. Like, that's not going to happen. Like, sometimes, like, and you have a second list for a reason, but sometimes, I think it's okay to actually just dodge. It's okay to actually plan to dodge and be like, well, if I get it, I get it, and it's going to suck, and I'll play the best game I can, but I may not be able to. I may not have a direct answer for this, but it's the list I want to play. It's a lot of fun. And in the matchups where it's solid, it is backbreaking. So you know what? Like, maybe I just play to my competencies, and where I'm not good, I just accept the fact that I'm not going to be good there. And then I'll try and play that matchup enough to understand the things I shouldn't do, which we talked about last week, right? Playing the matchups that are bad matchups, so you know what to do, and then finding a way to win there. I promise that's the end of my monologue.
Yeah. No, I was just looking at the topics. I was like, oh, I wonder if we can just blather more, or is that the – is this the last topic? And it is. It's the last one.
Yeah, yeah.
I think Brent, we can call it a night.
Yeah, yeah. Brent, what's going on in Springfield? Or, sorry, St. Louis.
There is just a 75-point single-day steamroller this weekend at game night, St. Louis. There is a 35-point Highlander at Carl Morgan's store in Springfield. And there is something in Des Moines.
Yeah, there's an Aristea tournament on Sunday and a War Machine tournament on Saturday.
What, have you figured out what you're taking to the War Machine event?
I don't know exactly. My list pair that I've been working with is just Sorsha and Strakov. Both of them have just, generally speaking, always been spectacular. Nothing's changed, despite the fact that there's a lot more anti-cold tech. But, yeah, that's the weird thing is Trolls. Strangely, my list pair has a problem with Trolls. But otherwise, it's fine. Actually, my Strakov list might be okay against the Trolls. And then, lastly, everybody go see A Quiet Place this weekend. So this week we can talk about it.
I will do my best.
I mean, I don't want any spoilers, but isn't it basically a horror movie where they have to be quiet?
It's literally a remake of Signs, only good. Also, just some sort of things to denote how good the movie was that is not spoiler. not, and I'm not saying that it's like life-affirming or some sort of big change. You know, it's not I don't know. It's not a huge deal, but it's good because it's a little bit of a throwback movie, back when movies sometimes gave you like a premise and then you lived in that premise for a bit and it was uncomfortable and just effed up and you were kind of riveted and you didn't have to have like a ton of action to sort of, you were just sort of caught up in sort of assimilating what was going on. And then what was going on was complicated enough that you were completely engaged. When I went to the movie, it was pretty packed. Only the front row was empty. And there was a guy... they're having some technical difficulties and there are the bunch of frat douchebags and they're like drinking and whatever and being just complete twats. And, one of the guys in the middle of the row that I was sitting was particularly being just sort of obnoxious, joking about all the previews, you know, trying to like, I'm like, you know, child really wanted his girlfriend and his buddies to know how funny he was and, was being loud about it. And then at one point the movie was basically starting and he's like burping. He's like, ugh. And his friends are like embarrassed, like, dude, come on. And he's just like, what, man? I'm just has a beer. And it, like, just, you know, just obnoxious, weird, you know. And I, like, you know, was sort of thinking, like, God, it's going to be a long fucking movie, you know. The whole movie, especially because, like, the first 5 minutes, I think, like, 7 minutes in, not a single noise. Like, I wasn't even sure that the speakers were turned on yet. And I was like, what is going on? Other than this idiot farting and burping and stuff. And, after like 7 minutes, I realized that they, like the entire theater, it was just a pin drop. This guy, without having to be told to shut up, he was like, you know, wide eyed staring. I just kind of remember looking like, oh, I haven't heard Mr. Comedian, you know, pipe up in a bit. And then sure enough, he's just like totally like, oh, with like slack jawed, you know, mouth agape, eyes glued. And then that was that. It was just the theater was just a pin drop the entire 2 hours. Also, aside from me realizing how quiet it was at the beginning, I didn't actually pay attention. I didn't even really pack. I didn't understand. I remember at some point in the movie, I'm like, this movie better be over pretty quick because I think my bladder's going to explode. And then the movie was over. It was like, holy crap, that was like 2 hours. Like, I haven't sat through a movie without having to go to the bathroom in so long. Yeah, this movie, I couldn't take my eyes off the screen for basically a second, other than a couple scenes where I was like, I've got to conveniently like look at my shoes for a second here. It's going to get awkward. But yeah, it's a pretty good one. And it's not like a horror movie. It's just sort of a cool, it's just a good movie. Just a good old fashioned movie you see because it's a movie. It's a cinema experience. I haven't really experienced, it's very rare these days. Everything's kind of repackaged, formulaic, ad tie-ins, campaigns, garbage, you know, public relations tours. It's what a movie is. The experience is just different these days. This is like an old classic. Like, we have a premise. Imagine a two-hour, we're here to provoke you in some way. It's like a two-hour Twilight Zone episode, you know, where the whole thing is about a payoff and an interesting experience. And then you sort of forget that. Like, Hollywood sort of lost sight of being able to do that. That's my
All right, you sold me.
That's my pitch. That's my elevator pitch. Three elevator pitches. Like three different people had to come in the elevator and be pitched, but still.
Thank you for tuning in to Muse on Movies.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Nigel.
Brent.
Seabass.
Later.